him. There are people who have dozens of columns themselves in their own homes. I remember being at an event in South Armagh a couple of years ago with Jim McCann was doing a book launch, the time that Jazz McCann wrote the book about his experiences in prison. And a friend of ours came up and said, "Would you see this?" And he pulled a column out, which was written by Bobby Sands, and which had been given to him by some local guy. And he didn't really know where it had came from or who the column was written to. It was like a general column that Bobby sent around the wings. And someone had managed to sort of keep that. And it always reminds me of an occasion when we were in H6 at the time, during the hunger strike, after Bobby had died. And a column came in from the leadership on the outside. And I read the column to the wing that I was in. And then at Mass on Sunday, I was given the column to Larry Marley and asked him to read it out to the guys in his wing. And I told him, "Whenever you finish with that, destroy it." And he said to me, "Are you mad?" He says, "That's our history." Mm-hmm. "That's our history." I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He says, "I save them and then I send them out, and that's all. That's to record the story of the H blocks."
So the comms not only helped during that period of time communication from the outside leadership to the inside leadership, but they continue to play a part in recording that historical period in our history.
Well, by the very nature, they do that. I mean, I don't think the Republican prisoners were sitting down writing columns saying, "This is going to be the historical record." All they were doing was relating the conditions of their lives that existed and the conditions that existed in the jails. And they were telling us about their worries and their worries about the politics of the time or what they thought of it. There's so many, many dimensions to it.
Well, Luke, I'd like to thank you both for speaking about this period in our history and bringing your own personal experience to the conversation almost 45 years ago now. And I think, without a doubt, you can see the importance of the communication system that was put in place both on the inside and on the outside, and at the contribution it is continuing to make in terms of the history of that period, particularly for people, young people, interested in that historic period in our struggle for freedom and independence. And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's program to help us grow our audience across our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guests, Tom Hartley and Shana Walsh. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Jim Gibney. Slán an Uisce. Bye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 18th verse of chapter Naml.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Hatta idha ataw ala wadin naml qalat namlatun ya ayyuhan naml udkhulu masakinakum la yahtimannakum sulayman wa junuduhu wa hum la yash'urun.
Until when they came upon the valley of the ants, an ant said, O ants, enter your dwellings, that you not be crushed by Solomon and his soldiers while they perceive not.
So, this verse suggests that Solomon with his great army started and they reached the valley of the ants. Hatta idha ataw ala wadi naml, until when they came to the valley of ants. Qalat namlatun ya ayyuha naml udkhulu masakinakum. One ant said, O you ants, get into your habitations. لا يحطمنكم سليمان وجنوده. So that Solomon and his host may not crush you. وهم لا يشعرون. They are being unaware. Now, there is a lot to be discussed regarding this beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, starting with the word naml. So, حتى إذا أتوا على واد النمل. The Arabic word naml philologically means creeping with small feet. The Quranic word namlatun that is mentioned, qalat namlatun, because of its Arabic nonation, can be meant a big ant which is a commander. In this case, there is a commandership, an administrationship in the lives of the ants, which is understandable from this very verse. Now, this nonation can also be meant as the sign of uncertainty of the ant. And in this case, namlatun is showing the message of the verse that if an undefined one, I mean undefined creature or ant in this case, gives a sympathetic warning, that warning must be attended to. This is also another fact that can be understood from this verse. But however it is, Solomon with his army started, they reached the valley of ants, and here an ant, addressing other ants, said that they should go into their dwellings. They should go back into their habitations because Solomon and his army might not crush them while they are unaware. The verse says, حتى إذا أتوا على وادي النمل قالت نملة يا أيها النمل ادخلوا مساكنكم لا يحطمنكم سليمان وجنوده وهم لا يشعرون. Until when Solomon and his army reached the valley of ants, an ant said, O you ants, get into your habitations so that Solomon and his hosts may not crush you, being unaware.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فَبَدَا وَضِيئًا كَالنُّجُومِ تَأَلُّقًا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, there are some explanations to say how this ant became aware of the presence of Solomon and his hosts in that land and how it announced this happening to other ants, which will be referred to later on. But the point that we can discuss now is the fact that it is understood from this sentence that the justice of Solomon was made manifest to even the ants, because the sentence implicitly means that if the hosts are aware of the existence of such ants and they are aware of the fact that there are some ants going on and about in that land, they will not tread that weak animal. Then if they tread the ants, it is because they do not know. وَهُمْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ, the verse says. Now, there are some other points to be discussed regarding this very verse, dear listeners. Now, وَادِ النَّمْلِ, the land of the valley of ants, suggests that the animals try to choose one specific place for themselves to live. And this is intentionally chosen. They have some kind of awareness of the situation, of the geographic characteristics of the territory they chose. So, Wadi Naml, which this suggests that the Naml and the ants had chosen that place intentionally. Also, when the verse says, قَالَتْ نَمْلَةٌ يَا أَيُّهَا النَّمْلِ, we see that there is also some kind of commandment between even the ants as well. So they have some superiors that try to force the others, or at least warn the others when the dangers arrive. And also, there is a kind of warning. There are some people who have the authority, who have the power, who have the right to warn the others if the danger arrives. And also, this means that if there are some human beings who feel that a kind of danger is close, who sense that something dangerous is about to happen, and they do not warn their other countrymates, they do not warn, yet they do not want the others to know about this danger, they are even less than an ant, because an ant feels the responsibility of warning the others when it feels that danger is close. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina wa Mawlana Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين.
We're going to try and answer four questions. So if you brothers and sisters remember, the last time we spoke, we talked about five must-have traits for the mu'min. Five must-have traits. If we don't have these traits, but really between us and Allah, بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَ اللَّهِ, we're making real effort to acquire these traits, then yes, we can also be called mu'mineen. One of them that we talked about last time was a healthy fear of God. We talked about that last time. Having a healthy fear of God. But the other ones that we want to answer today are the following four questions. Number one, what should our relationship with the Quran be like? What should my relationship with the Quran be like? Number two, what role does tawakkul, or trusting in Allah, relying on Allah, what role does that play in the life of the mu'min? Number three, what are three acceptable takeaways when talking about that all-important concept that we've all heard, iqamatus salah, establishing the prayer? When that's an order for all of us, what does that mean? What are two acceptable takeaways? And then finally, last but not least, keeping that ayat that I mentioned in the beginning in mind, there are some people who spend, who try, who make effort, and in the end, it's all in vain. The last one is Quranic infaq. What does that mean? What does it mean to spend in the way of God? So, because we're relearning Islam, and it's difficult to unlearn something that we never learned before, we came to a belief about a certain thing, about Islam. We all love Islam, but we might not have been introduced to Islam through the Quran, through the verses of the Quran, through pondering the Quran. So because of that, we ask God for help. As always, we're going to start with that beautiful hadith, that beautiful dua of Imam Sadiq. He starts off with, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Salawat. Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The Imam says this, وَأَرِنِ الْحَقَّ حَقًّا حَتَّى أَتَّبِعَهُ. O God, show me the truth to be truth, so that I embrace it, so that I accept it, so that I follow it. What else? وَأَرِنِ الْبَاطِلَ بَاطِلًا. Show me, O God, falsehood to be falsehood, batil to be batil, hatta ajtanibahu, so that I can avoid it. So we're asking Allah for guidance. Our hearts are ready to be retaught Islam as we should. So back to our ayat of the Quran. So brothers and sisters, now if we can turn to surah number 8, surah Anfal, surah number 8, verse number 2. So it should be this, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Innamal mu'minun. So this is God speaking. Only these are mu'mineen. Only these are believers. Innamal mu'minun. Only they are believers. What are they like? Alladhina. Those who? Idha dhukir Allah. When Allah is mentioned, wajilat qulubuhum. Their hearts tremble in awe of God. They fear God. When God is mentioned, khaf, khauf, right? Wajilat means khafat. Wajilat means there's khauf, there's literal khauf. I do fear God. I've recognized His majesty, His glory. I have that healthy fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now to our questions. So today's questions. And we'll start and we'll go through them, inshallah. The first question is, the second must-have trait for the mu'min. What should my relationship with the Qur'an be like? I'm a mu'min. I want to serve the cause. I'm here to hasten the reappearance of the Imam of the time. What should my relationship with the Qur'an be like? Back to our verse, brothers and sisters. So, the verse is this. وَإِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُهُ. When the ayat of Allah, when the signs of Allah, when the verses of the Quran are recited for these mu'mineen, zadatum imana, it increases their faith. A true mu'min or mu'mina, when the ayat of the Quran are recited, so this is whether I'm listening to somebody else reciting the Quran, or I myself am reciting the Quran, it increases me in faith. There's a catch though. When is it that when the ayat of the Quran are recited, or I am reciting them, that increases me in faith? This one is going, we're going to go for another ayat of Quran. So what we're talking about is one of the miraculous effects of the Quran. It helps me increase in iman. One of the miraculous effects. When is it that reciting the Quran helps me to increase in faith? Is it everybody who recites the Quran? Surah number 38 and verse number 29. So, brothers and sisters, let's see if you can follow along with me in the Arabic. We're looking for an answer. What are we looking for? When is it that reciting the Quran deepens my faith? Is it everybody who recites the Quran? Is it automatic? I just sit back and my faith is increased? Or is it something that I do? And if I do this, then that happens. Whether I'm listening to somebody else, or whether I myself am reciting. God says this about His book. Kitabun. So the Quran is a book. Anzalnahu ilayka mubarak. We sent it down to you. We revealed it to you. Mubarak. So it's a blessed book that we, God, have sent down to you. What was the goal of Quran? When is it that believers' faith is increased? Let's look at the Arabic of this, brothers and sisters. What was the goal? God says in the Quran. Same verse. لِيَدَّبَّرُوا آيَاتِهِ. In order that they, plural, not Rasulullah, they, you and I, mu'mineen and mu'minat, plural, we, yadabbaru ayate, they ponder its verses. So when you and I go to the Quran looking for answers, trying to understand. Why is it that it's so important to read the translation of Quran? I'm looking for answers. I'm looking for guidance, direction. What am I supposed to do? What does God want from me? When I read the Quran looking for guidance, then the Quran, it grows my faith. My faith becomes deeper.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
أتلته
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. For these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers, or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans and those that come after us draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home? In November 2010, the U.S. Army charged 5 soldiers from its 5th Striker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice. And sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served. And by that I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Striker 5 case. As the Striker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of 3 Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted-for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted 2 farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes repositioned. Now at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest, and he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. Went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and it lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, Holmes get down and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which of course we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went, opened one tent. He threw. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Had graduated from college, didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army. Right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq, and the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not, he was not capable, he was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD, and it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. You know, we've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical. Some critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, it was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image. American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts, and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out, "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly, within a couple of months this insurgency developed, they hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior. The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, is going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception, but just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home, that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I gotta tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are 2 guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musawi. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And in this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. For today, we want to talk about an important topic, and that is the difference, or it's better to say the comparison, as it is between the Western democracy and the Islamic one, as the term that is coined as Mardum Salariye Dini. You know, when we talk about democracy in the Western world, the first thing that comes to our mind is the secular political system.
Mm-hmm.
But when we are talking about Islam, this human dignity, you know, has come to the scene. But the case is that now where is the place of rationality in the we can say Islamic system or the system of values? So when we, from one side, if you are going to pay attention to obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with his own system of values, but from the other side you have these human beings in the 21st century with his system of value and rationality at the top. So what are we going to do with the concept of rationality over here?
Yeah. So I think it's pure rationality that we see in the philosophy that Islam has actually defined for itself. Look, Islam says the values are absolute, not relative.
Okay.
It means that if something is bad, so it is bad forever.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is good, it is good, and it has to be praised and respected. But but in the other schools, as I said earlier, they just look at a social aspect of it. They say, for example, this might be bad in a society, committing such an action might be bad in a society, but as for me, as a person, I practice it. It's because I'm free.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, this is the difference. When you have no limitation for you, but we have these limitations defined by whom? By the Creator.
Okay.
Let me give you an example. When a car actually is going to be given from a company to a person who has recently bought it, what happens? The car actually has been tuned based on some orders and some formulas, and so you cannot say that I can take this car everywhere.
So different parts are assembled by the factory and given to you as a car.
So the vehicle cannot be used in any way you like.
That's right.
The person who made this car knows how to actually put
the parts
together, right?
Yes, yes.
The car itself has no idea what has been actually. So
the driver has no idea what's happening mechanically speaking inside the car. Okay.
So the one who has created you actually gave you a formula for your life, and he knows how to live very well in this world. So he is the creator. He knows as the person who made this person.
So now the question would be that, so this ideal system that you are talking about, Islamically speaking,
might be practiced well at the time of its true practitioners, I mean, prophets and the infallible imams. But what about now?
So
I mean, the value system that you say can govern the people and has a system of values for the people in order to give them their roles and rights in the society must be, in a better sense, be practiced by true practitioners. I mean, at the time of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams. So look, what about now? Because the type of...
Islam as a program has not been actually revealed for a certain period of time.
It has
been revealed for the whole mankind for in the course of history till the end of the day.
This is true. The value system is the same. But you know, extracting the new rules from that and adapting...
So even Islam is open in this sense. Okay. Look, up until the time of, for example, imams, those who were present, so they were the real interpreters of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the qayba and occultation of Imam alayhi salam, there is the solution of ijtihad is open. And the ijtihad is something which is... It's something which is dynamic and it is available every time. So those who are ruwat al-hadith, those who are interpreters of hadith from the language of Ahlul Bayt, those who are calling them general deputies of imam, they are eligible to interpret the hadith for the day that we are in.
Mm-hmm.
So they can easily actually interpret and give us the laws based on the Islamic values. And
also, can I add a point
to
that, though?
Yes,
now, what you mentioned is that you saying, okay, Islam is a system and needs someone to maintain it.
Yes.
So you're kind of trying to imply the fact that we constantly need an imam or a prophet to maintain it.
Yes.
Now, with Islam, there are two sides to it. Now, there is the government side where you have, you know, Allah appoints the ma'sumeen or the infallibles or the governors of the system. But the system itself, it was made very clear to the followers of that system, that you as a person has what we call wajibat, right? You have got compulsory actions that you need to abide by whether you have someone governing or not. So, for example, now, whether the imam is present or not, whether even the deputies are present or not, as a Muslim, I have certain things. For example, if we go by the Ten Commandments, thou I shall not kill, right?
Yes.
Thou shall not steal. These are set laws. I don't need... Mm-hmm. An imam. I don't need someone to be in government to tell me this is my obligation.
Okay.
So Islam says you have certain obligations.
Okay.
Now, with other things, you might need to, you know, things to be explained to you and stuff like that. But the main things that when it comes to the rights of people, dealing with other people, they're already set, predefined. Everyone knows them.
That's right.
Whether it is an imam or not. So Islam itself, so you can say it's self-maintained when it comes to the person himself. So now I know my duties.
Yeah.
Now sometimes, okay, we can say when it comes to matters of new affairs and things like that and how I should deal with them in terms of halal and haram, maybe I have to refer to a marja, I have to refer to an imam.
Okay.
But the basics themselves, they are set.
So then we
so
have
for example, if we do a comparison between Islam and the secular system or the countries that we have. For example, Islam from the beginning said there is no difference between a black man and a white man.
Yes.
From the beginning.
Yes.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala eliminate that kind of level between people.
Yes.
Now we still have that problem in the West, for example, black people and white people.
Yes.
Until today, the 21st century.
Yes.
So as a Muslim, if I go back 1,000 years ago, my values are set in this kind of regard. So we don't constantly need that kind of government.
That's right.
Yes, it, as part of Islam needs that kind of government, but initially saying that as a person, me and you, our duties are set and clear.
Only for the new problems on Masa'il al-Mustahdath.
Exactly.
But
Muslim, he knows that he should not kill, he should not take the rights of others, he should not steal. These are set.
But see, we have so many problems in the Muslim lands because there are so many interpretations out of a same fixed value system among different schools of thought. You know, the problem is here that in the West, in the secular system, as we call it, the democracy or the republic, the system of the law is replaced with the religious one, so the separated church and the state, okay? And that's the law that is ruling over the country. In the Muslim lands, in the Islamic schools of thought, now we have different interpretations out of the same system of the value. And still the people are not ruling over the people. I mean, people from the same classes. Still, there is a government because, politically speaking, the system of the government and these political different political positions are coming from the Western political sciences.
Mm.
And then we want to annex or cling a kind of Islamic value system to that so they do not come together. still the people are now ruling over the people, as you see in the yeah. Persian Gulf, you know, in the Arab countries, there's still the aristocratic king system over there, ruling over the people, okay, in the Muslim lands. In Islamic Republic of Iran, we have this republic that the everybody's vote is counted, okay? It's not like representative elect in the U.S. or something like that. The elites of the society decide for the people. But still, we have the problem of...